on Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Hi, I'm Andrew McFarlane. Tune into the next Prairie Musicians to hear my arrangements of some of your favorite songs. Thanks. We'll see you there.
Watch Prairie Musicians tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is out on medical leave. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we have our Main Street Eats segment with Sue Balcom. But we are going to start today with Drew Combs, the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office, to talk about a recent trip to Qatar and to Turkey as part of a delegation of North Dakota representatives. Drew, thanks for joining us today.
You bet, Ashley. Thank you for having me.
Why those countries?
Well, it's actually a long story. You know, of course, anytime we do these kind of missions, we do our research and our due diligence and really target where we're spending our time and where we're spending our dollars. But the Qatari portion was actually on the invite of the Qatari government. We've had some interactions with the Qatari ambassador to the United States, and he invited us to come to his country, and we reciprocated and went. Interesting story. The Qatar is actually closed to visitors, so we were actually granted a special permit, and that was due to the pandemic, and they're trying to combat the COVID-19.
Yeah, and Qatar is a small country, but it is quite a wealthy country. Global Finance Magazine ranks it as number 4, which, by the way, is per capita higher than the U.S., which is currently at number 7 on that list. Still doing, of course, quite well, especially since we have such a huge population relative to Qatar. But I was on the U.S. Trade Office website and looking at imports and exports and the trade relationship between U.S. and Qatar. And U.S. to Qatar, our ag products are, upwards of $139 million. Qatar to the U.S., ag products totaling $32,000?
That's probably correct. Qatar is relatively a small nation. I think the population of the Qataris is about 350,000. And, of course, I think their real population is about 1.6. And that's due to the expat population.
Right. Only 12% are Qatari nationals.
That's right. And the thing about Qatar in the Middle East, and one of the reasons why it was a target for North Dakota is to – encourage some of that trade, that back and forth trade. And you got to remember, Qatar, it's a desert. And that's the things you look for in trade. They have something we want and we have something they want. We've got this, we're the breadbasket of the upper Midwest and mostly the world. So why not go over there and see if we can't get some trade going?
Well, so let's talk about what they are offering us, the top import categories. And these are numbers coming back from 2019. But mineral fuels, $700 million. Inorganic chemicals, $39 million. Fertilizers, $399 million. So they do have some things to offer to the U.S.
Yes, they do. And the important thing to remember about this mission, this wasn't a typical trade mission. It had a trade component to it.
Okay.
But this was also working with the Department of or North Dakota Department of Commerce in their foreign direct investment mission. So part of that whole mission was to look at and talk to some of their investors and tell them about some of the good things we have going on in North Dakota, especially they're the energy experts. Especially when they're dealing with natural gas, they have an abundance of natural gas and have worked with that for decades now. North Dakota's got a gas issue. We have more gas than we know what to do with. And, reaching out to some of those folks over in Qatar and helping us figure out that problem as well.
Yeah, the Qatar Investment Authority is one of the largest investment firms in the world. Qatar itself owns an enormous amount of property in London. They have luxury properties in Paris and Milan. They own property all over. They own the company that owns British Airways, for example. Now, North Dakota has a pretty long history of trying to limit the amount of foreign-owned land. Now, I know foreign-owned land and foreign investments are different, but are we trying to ease up on that? Is this in part about trying to bring in more money, and do we give up some of the sovereignty of the land in that process?
You know what? That's a really good question. And as far as the land goes, the answer to that is no. You know, we're actually looking at the Qataris and other folks to possibly take minority interest in some of these bigger capital projects that we have going on in the state, especially in the energy world. It wouldn't be private ownership of land. You know, it's we're asking them to invest in already built facilities or ones that are going to be built, but they would, you know, by their own admission, look to take minority interest in those.
Hmm. Do people worry? Is it a matter of national security to curtail, in some respects, the amount of foreign influence in our biggest industries, ag and energy?
Well, absolutely. You know, and that's something that our folks in Washington's monitor and are abreast of. And it's the same thing with any country you're dealing with. They have similar rules and regulations, and you just got to be careful, you know, and follow the guidelines and bring all the players to the table and figure out how this works.
So who are all the players specific to North Dakota? Because you were there, the Ag Commissioner Doug Goring was there. What other companies are interested in exploring foreign direct investment opportunities with Qatar and Turkey?
Sure. And we also had Commissioner Lamont, our Commerce Commissioner, was also there. And again, Commerce, the foreign direct investment piece is really Commerce's role. We take a supporting role in the FDI mission, and we take the lead on trade, and Commerce backs us up on that. But we did have three companies that went with us, and one of them represented the UAS industry, which is unmanned aerial systems.
Hmm.
As well as we had two energy companies that primarily dealt in biofuels and ethanol.
And why those industries?
Well, they, you know, the Qataris let us know well in advance that, you know, we're really good in the energy space. You know, we've got a lot of investment in that area. And we're looking in the petroleum primarily, and we're looking for new energy options as well. And they're not only looking for investment opportunities, but they're also looking for folks to come naturally to come invest in Qatar. And that's something they're looking at because everybody in the world knows that, you know, hydrocarbons, it's great, our oil and gas sector. But it's not going to be around 200-300 years from now. I mean, you're going to deplete that resource, and you know you've got to move on and try to find other avenues to create energy for folks.
Right. So, what are those? I mean, I'm thinking: are we talking wind and solar, or are we talking, you know, algal oil or something I've never even heard of?
Sure. Well, you know, here in North Dakota, it's one of the things I really love about this state is our all the above. Energy sector, and we're an energy powerhouse. So when we look at energy, again, North Dakota being all the above, we're taking that message overseas and look, saying, hey, you know, we can produce oil and gas, but we can also get, you know, help you out with wind, your ethanol, your biofuels, however you want to produce it.
Does the North Dakota Trade Office focus exclusively on international trade?
No, ma'am. Matter of fact, our what we go by is we expand trade across borders. In Minnesota's a border there, as well as, you know, you get county borders. We just want to get the movement of you know, products, and we're here to help out in whichever border you're crossing. We're here to help you out.
Hmm. Do you ever advise on policy for the state, for example? And I'm thinking going back to that foreign land ownership, you know, by the end of 2019, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, foreign entities held roughly 35 million acres of U.S. ag land. And China, in particular, has land totaling almost $2 billion in the United States. And again, going back to North Dakota, has this long tradition of anti-corporate farming, limited foreign national ownership. But I'm wondering, do you have a role when it comes to legislation and policy?
You know, I get asked on policy every once in a while, not that one in particular, but having worked in the land space previously, you know, I do know it's a concern for North Dakotans, and you know, to be quite honest with you, I'd be concerned if, you know, we had a foreign entity coming and buying all the land. But that's really I would defer to our governor and ag commissioner and folks like that to help, you know, draft those policies, what's good for North Dakota. And I do have to give kudos to the ag commissioner as well as the commerce commissioner. North Dakota, and I'm not just saying this because both of them sit on my board, but it's the truth. You couldn't find better representatives of North Dakota in telling that North Dakota story. It was just phenomenal how they conducted business and handled themselves, and it was really, really neat to watch.
When you say tell that North Dakota story, how do you sell North Dakota to foreign entities?
Yep, and that's a really good question. And I tell you, that's one of my favorite things because, to be honest with you, once I get in front of somebody and able to tell that North Dakota story, that is an easy sell, especially if I can get somebody here and tell them the story and take them around and show them all the good things we got going on in the state. Again, I have yet to fail. Easy sell. There's a lot of opportunities in this state, and that's the message that we're all trying to pitch.
We're visiting today with Drew Combs. He is the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office, recently back from a trade mission in Qatar and Turkey. How often are you either going on or hosting delegation trips like this?
It really depends on, you know, the environment and what's going on. And, of course, you know, there's a budget aspect to it. But we try to get out at least 2 to 3 times a year. You know, it depends on which funding mechanism we're using or what the particular mission is. But, you know, we try to keep it at 2. But, you know, COVID, I got to tell you, we haven't been out in well over a year. So this was the first us going out. Now, we have what's called reverse missions where we bring folks into the state to be able to show them and tell them that story. And we've had quite a few of those in the past year. But this is really the first trade mission that we've went on of any depth since COVID.
You know, I've mentioned that this was a trip to both Qatar and to Turkey, but then most of my questions have been about Qatar. Is there anything to add that was specific to Turkey regarding the trade meetings?
Sure. In Turkey, it was a since we're in the region and it was on the way there. So we stopped off, and that was the reason for that was is we did have some folks who we'd been talking to in Turkey. So it was specifically meant to meet with those folks, primarily businesses. But we did were able to meet with quite a few folks in their various ministries and government.
How important is just the actual location of Turkey? You know, Qatar is very solidly in the Middle East. Turkey, you know, with it starting to touch into Greece, but then, you know, starts to border on countries that are more solidly Middle Eastern. Is there anything to just the strategic location of Turkey itself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you go back in history, you know, Turkey has always been the gateway to a lot of commerce just for their location throughout the eons. So that rings true still today. You know, I was just talking to a group of Ukrainian diplomats, and, you know, a lot of their commerce and energy and that sort of thing problems are going to have to be solved with Turkey, because that's how they get their freight, you know, through the Bosphorus, where there's actually a division between Europe and Asia, and Turkey straddles that. So Turkey's a really good partner to have, especially given that central location.
There's some interesting reporting coming out of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, specifically a series from Ignacio Calderon, who talked about climate change deniers and how big production egg companies spent millions of dollars in lobbying to influence our laws so that the understanding of how production egg can impact climate change was skewed, and now they're saying the ag industry is trying to position itself as part of the solution. How do you look at how specifically North Dakota farmers, but farmers in general, are taking that step in climate change?
Well, I can tell you from an international perspective, in talking to a lot of folks all over the world, and again, you know, North Dakota being this ag powerhouse, you're going to talk about ag a lot. So I think it's very interesting that everybody I speak with, there's always some component to environmental, we want to do better, you know, and that's what a lot of these conversations revolve around. You know, even you can look at ag and you know, with biofuels as well as, you know, the ethanol, you know, that they feed each other. So that's the interest in that I keep hearing a lot of when you're talking about these different kind of fuel types, is to help with that environmental impact. But I think it's really interesting that the new trend, I guess, and probably rightly so, is how do we not only make money and get these deals done, but how do we also, you know, do it in an environmentally sound way?
Does the North Dakota Trade Office, does that have anything to do with this specialty crop grant programming that you do? Because you think North Dakota farming, and it's really easy to think soybean, corn, wheat, but there are grant opportunities available for peas, bean, lentils, and then confectionery sunflowers, which those are the ones for human consumption and not so much bird seed and for seed oil. Is any of that specific to climate change, or why those crops?
Okay, so the specialty crop grant, you know, we do utilize it quite a bit, and so do our companies. We have a big event every year that's actually in Dubai. We send those producers of those specialty crops there. It's one of those things where environmental it doesn't come up very much, because, you know, you're really when those situations and those missions, when you're talking, it's buyer and producer, or, you know, so it's one guy's wanting the product and the other guy's willing to sell it to him. So not a whole lot of environmental talk that I'm aware of.
Okay. Going back to the trade mission, I'm really curious about the cultural norms, and what did you most need to be aware of for trying to do business specifically in Qatar, since it's very firmly a Middle Eastern country and they have very different social norms than we do?
Sure, and that's one of the things the trade office does and makes any of our delegates aware of, that there is cultural differences and there's certain things you should and should not do. But, you know, one of the things, too, I've spent a big portion of my life in the Middle East, and the fact of the matter is when you get to these places, yes, there's cultural differences. But one of the things I've learned over my travels is that people are just people. And, you know, and if you make an attempt at adhering to some of their cultural restraints and things they hold dear, and if you make an attempt, they notice that, and it goes a long way. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there's – and I'll give you a simple one. It's pretty taboo. In the Middle East, in Islamic culture, to cross your legs and show the people at your bottom of your feet.
Oh, I'm doing that right now.
Yep. But that's one of them things that, you know, they know you're a Westerner and they know that Westerners cross their legs. And it's – if you're conscious of it and they can see you, you know, moving your legs or whatever, they get it. Nobody's going to be offended.
Mm-hmm. What about there are – times where those norms might be something that is far more egregious. Do you ever specifically not work with a company or with a government because of child labor practices or the rights of women in the area?
Absolutely. So when we get the idea of a mission, a lot of these mission where we're going and that sort of thing actually comes from business. And they say, hey, we're looking at trading in Malaysia. So we take a hard look at what's going on in Malaysia. We let, of course, our board know. And we start, you know, asking those questions. I mean, is there going to be a problem? And we let all the potential participants know of those issues. And we might, you know, say, hey, we're not going to go there. I'm not going to mention any countries, but we've actually had that happen where we just didn't think it was in our best interest to go there and maybe engage them a different way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's going to happen.
So you are the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. That's not the kind of title that, you know, little kids sit there and think, this is the kind of job I want. Give us your career trajectory. How is it that you ended up in this important role?
Oh, wow. That's a long story. But
we have 90 seconds left.
Okay. So long story short, I've always wanted to do something like this. And I think it's a good North Dakota story. If you can't tell, I'm not originally from these parts. But I got here about
– just a little accent there.
Yep. Got here about 15 years ago. I heard about the trade office, made my home in North Dakota. So I'm not saying I'm stuck here, but this is where we call home. And to ply my trade and to do what I wanted to do, there's very few options. Washington, D.C. Would be the obvious choice, but this was my only opportunity to go out and, you know, help develop trade as well as, you know, kind of be the ambassador to North Dakota. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just a perfect fit. And I tell you, it took me a while to get here. Lots of tries, and I finally made it.
Drew Combs is the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office, just back from a trade mission trip to Qatar and to Turkey. Thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, Tom Ezern has a Plainsfolk essay, and we visit with Sue Balcom from Main Street Eats. But first, this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. Great Plains natural gas customers in the Wahpeton area will see their monthly bills increase between $11 and $12 starting in August. It's a temporary increase brought on because of the February cold spell in Texas and other parts of the southern United States.
Prices spiked, as we know, during that February cold weather event over a 7-day period in particular.
Public Service Commissioner Brian Crotius says there were several reasons for that spike.
One, Texas produces 26% of the nation's natural gas. Half of that production was curtailed during the cold weather event because wellheads were freezing. So that had a significant impact in itself. When you essentially take 13% of the natural gas supply out of the equation, pricing is going to go up.
Krasha says utilities do not make money from the natural gas itself. The increase will be in effect for a 14-month period. North Dakota State University has updated its COVID-19 policies for the 2021-22 school year. An email from President Dean Brashani says masks will continue to be optional with some exceptions. Brashani says faculty may require masks to be worn in their classes at their discretion, and healthcare operations on campus, including student health service, will continue to be able to mandate masks in accordance with regular health care protocols. The policy says NDSU will continue to expect students, faculty, and staff to follow quarantine and isolation guidance from the North Dakota Department of Health. For students living in residence halls, quarantine and isolation options will be provided on campus. Brashani says NDSU is emphasizing the return to in-person instruction this year, but faculty will provide alternative arrangements to students who have to quarantine or isolate. Mass testing events on campus will not be an option this year, but student testing will still be available for individuals with or without symptoms. And coming soon, the Dakota Commerce Center, a large industrial park to be built adjacent to the Amazon Fulfillment Center, nearing completion in North Fargo. Paul Hyde of Minneapolis-based Hyde Development says the purchase closed on the 42-acre site July 1st. The project will cost between $53 million and $55 million.
We're going to develop four buildings on the site, totaling 630,000 square feet, a combination of office warehouse and bulk warehouse buildings. We're literally right across the street from the Amazon Distribution Center, just on the other side of 44th Avenue North. And we've been starting our soil correction work, site work, already underway for the first two buildings.
Completion of the first 127,000 square foot office warehouse should be complete in January 2020. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. What happens when a scholar writes a book and an academic reads that book? Well, you get a nice series of conversations here on Main Street. Clay Jenkinson recently wrote the book The Language of Cottonwoods, which was a search for identity in North Dakota. And in this week's Plains Folk essay, historian Tom Ezern reflects on that with his essay, Who Are We Now?
It is important that we have conversations about our beloved state, says Clay Jenkinson, introducing his book, The Language of Cottonwoods. I love North Dakota with all my heart. It is no great insight to say that the identity question, who am I, who are we, is the oldest chestnut in the literary pantry of the prairies, but it still can be roasted to sweetness. Clay says his working title for the book was, perhaps is, So Who Are We Now? The overall posture of the book holds this as a public question, perhaps a matter of policy. The language of the work suggests it is also a personal one. Clay lays out his main questions clearly. At the core is an identity crisis. The decline of the traditional agrarian character of the state has left us in a vacuum. Farmers are few. Old-fashioned rural ties no longer bind. Threshing rings are museum artifacts. Try to have a potluck in Fargo, and most of the stuff on the board has a store label on it, hasn't even been taken out of the plastic container and put into a serving dish. The erosion of identity leaves us vulnerable to invasive trends and toxic politics. This decline leads to another alarming fact, the deterioration of our relationship with the land. Interestingly, Clay credits hunting as an important recreational pursuit that maintains a tie with the landscape. It is not enough, however. Much of the language of Cottonwoods is devoted to our failure in the face of extractive boom to stand for the conservation of our iconic landscapes, particularly the Little Missouri River Valley, which failure is representative of our general inability to come to grips with extractive economic enterprise, as if the only alternatives were simple-minded cheerleading and reactionary opposition. Clay is sober and reasonable as to all this, mostly. I think I would add that although conservation seemed for a while to have tamed the extractive character of field agriculture, we've lost that battle too. Finally, and why is this so late in the bullet list? There is the matter of the settler society coming to terms with Native Americans as neighbors. Perhaps this wants treatment as the genesis question in the identity complex rather than as a piece of the puzzle. Clay desires to envision a future North Dakota that is post-agrarian and, in the long term, post-carbon. We are handicapped by the weakness of our spirit of place, which is both physical and metaphysical, and by internal divisions, the old East versus West, country versus city, imperial caste thing. Clay partakes of some of this himself, I think, which may be inevitable for a Jefferson scholar. There's some other baggage weighing us down, as evidenced by the North Dakota 101 section of the book, laying out some assumptions about the Flickertail State. Here, the hidden hand of historian Elwin Robinson is not even gloved, as Clay dwells upon our remoteness. I just don't buy this as a pre-existing condition for the 21st century. If anyone is isolate in North Dakota, it is by choice. Then there is his glib acceptance of the proposition that North Dakotans are unusually, especially, perhaps supremely, nice people. Often it may seem that way. I felt that way in a gathering of friends a few days ago. And I certainly feel that way when my students choose to forgive my forgetful faults or my listeners here put up with my familiar fetishes and occasional rants. But Clay rises to a level of prairie exceptionalism in regard to this matter of niceness that I cannot reconcile with either broader knowledge or personal experience. This is a mythic weakness we should walk back a bit. I take here a critical posture toward the language of Cottonwoods because, as Mike Jacobs says, it is an important book. I will return to chew on some of its most interesting propositions.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up next, Sue Balcom.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
Next time on The Poles, it's a long way from listening to words.
So the baby hears mama.
To actually being able to say them.
The baby starts to babble and doesn't quite get it right. Goes ma, ma, you know. Over and over to try to get the sound, and one day goes mama.
What scientists are discovering about learning language.
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So are you up to your bum in cucumbers?
Well, as a matter of fact, if you're out there shopping at the farmer's market, now's the time to get cucumbers and green beans because they have been like crazy. But there's good parts to that and there's bad parts to that. Now, I don't know if you've ever raised your own cucumbers, but if you turn around two times in your garden, they go from pickling size to maybe feed the deer size.
Right.
Because yeah, fast. They are prolific growers. And my vines have taken over my garden. It's been absolutely crazy. And so at the farmer's market, on the street, every grocery store I go to, if somebody knows that I grow for a living, they're like, do you have picklers? Do you have picklers? And I'm thinking, no. because pickler cucumbers are, of course, the teeny tiniest little ones, and they're harder to pick, they're harder to see, and like I said earlier, that they go from 0 to 90 feet long in about 2 minutes. So right now, that is what is at huge demand here in North Dakota, and it's funny because I know somebody on the coast that says he couldn't sell a pickler for $1 a pound because they all want slicing cucumbers there. But in North Dakota, we have this long ingrained need to pickle things, whether it's beets, cucumbers, watermelon, you name it. We are a pickling bunch of crazy people. And the only way you get pickling cucumbers is if you know somebody that will save them for you.
Okay.
And I will not do that anymore.
So it's not a variety of pickles.
No.
It's when you pick them?
It's timing. Timing is everything. So we're out in the high tunnel, and the temperatures have been insane lately. And so we're sweating where I didn't even know I had sweat glands to pick these little picklers. And so if somebody wants them and I have them, they have to pay me in advance because you get mauled when you're at the farmer's market at 8:05. All the picklers are gone.
Wow.
It's crazy. But, you know, so what's the thing about pickling your own cucumbers? Like, I'll pickle them for you because I happen to believe a few things will give you greater success when you're pickling your own cucumbers than not. And I thought that's maybe what we should talk about a little bit today.
Okay, so what are those tips? We start with a small cucumber. Now
right.
What?
Well, first of all, why would you want a pickle in the first place?
Because it's more delicious and better for your stomach sometimes.
It is. And Cleopatra, if it was good enough for Cleopatra, it's good enough for us. Pickling.
Yeah, she never made any questionable decisions.
Right. Oh, no. But you're right about the fact that the brine is really good for you, especially if they're more naturally fermented than not. And I have people that will come by and they won't pick up a jar if the seal is broken on it. However, I find that just means that they're fermenting like crazy. So how do you get a good pickle? Well, you have to start, like you said, with small cucumbers. Good luck finding them. But if you do find some, you're going to need a couple other things like distilled water, pickling spice, dill, garlic, hot peppers, and pickling salt.
Why distilled water? Why can't you just get something from the tap?
Well, just like using pickling salt for when you're pickling things, there are additional additives to your city water that may or may not help you get the appropriate brine for your cucumbers. So I did used to use water that I let set so that the ammonia and chlorine and all that stuff could evaporate from it. But, you know, my friend swears by distilled water. And so I thought, well, for the price of distilled water, it's really worth it because it takes a lot of skill to pickle. It doesn't take a lot of ingredients, but you got to have your cucumbers and you have to cut the blossom end off. That's very, very important thing to do. That blossom end seems to soften those pickles. Now, another thing is that I am a firm believer that they should go straight from the vine into the jar, like within an hour. So being fortunate enough to be growing my own little tiny cucumbers, I go out and pick. I get them in cold water. I cut the blossom end off. My brother cuts both ends off so that they fit in the jar better.
Okay.
But yeah, it's fine. They flatten out that way, and he does these little double rows, and I'm like, well, I don't know who's picking your cucumbers for you, but mine are inconsistent sizes. You know, they range from the size of my pinky finger to, you know, the somewhat bigger ones that we try to sneak in there just because we don't know what else to do with them. So when I load a jar, like, first of all, I assemble all these ingredients, and I use a pickling recipe that my grandmother used. It's, you know, one part vinegar to four parts of water, and then there's some sugar and salt in there. And you can find these recipes everywhere. And I would recommend, if you're just beginning to do this, that you might contact Extension or go to the Extension website and get an approved recipe. Mine is maybe a little bit more towards the naturally fermented brine as opposed to a real vinegary pickle. So you've got this nice jar that you've sterilized and you're heating your lids, which is something you should do no matter what you're canning, is warm up your lids. Don't boil them, but warm them up so the rubber is soft. That will help increase the ability to seal. So then I take the jar and I throw in a big toe of garlic and a great big wad of dill. And this all comes out of my garden, a great big chili pepper, and then about a quarter to a third of a teaspoon of pickling spice, which I buy in bulk because it has way, way, way more flavor because it's a fresher spice than the stuff that's been on your store shelf for quite a while. And I don't like a lot of pickling spice in my pickles, but, you know, it's personal preference.
What's in a pickling spice mix?
Things like bay leaf, chili peppers, coriander, black peppers, and cloves. Okay. And they're usually whole. They're not ground up, although I do have some pickling spice that's been reduced to almost flaky salt texture. So you can't see what's in that blend, but usually you'll see the whole, you know, there's probably maybe even some little bits of cinnamon stick in there. So it's spices that you use to give that distinct flavor. Now, if you like garlic dill, you want to add more than one toe of garlic, which we used to fight over that pickled garlic when we were kids.
It is delicious.
So yeah, that's a good thing. And then the next thing is loading those jars. So first of all, you get your water and vinegar, salt and sugar, whatever goes into your brine recipe. Get that, bring it up to a boil. Make sure your canner is bubbling away. I always put on a teapot for some extra water. It's kind of like having a baby, you know. You need some towels and some hot water and then whatever else you're going to do here. You're going to take a sterilized or a well-washed warm jar, and you're going to start with a larger cucumbers at the bottom, and you're going to ram those things in as tight as you possibly can. And then you use the littler ones to kind of fill in all the space up to the neck of the jar. If you go past the neck, you're going to never get a good seal. You always have to have space in there for expansion and for that liquid to start boiling.
Okay. Did you already say this? Do the jars need to be hot too?
Yes. I usually pour boiling water into them and leave them in the sink until I'm ready to use them. And so I have that and the lid that's hot. So then you pour your hot brine.
Everything is hot.
Everything should be hot. Okay. So then you pour your hot brine over your jars right up to the neck and then wipe the rim. I actually saw a television program where this guy did not wipe the rim of his jars when he was talking about canning. If you see or feel any chips in that, it will not seal and it's not safe to use because the whole jar might crack. I would recommend also checking this before you even bother washing your jars and throw any jars that are not Ball or Kerr out the door or use them for something else. Don't use old mayonnaise jars. You know, you can only recycle a glass jar so many times before it becomes brittle. And what you don't want is it blowing up in your canner because, oh, that's such a mess, and it's such a heartbreak to lose something that you've spent so much time preparing.
So these have to be pressure canned?
No. I actually don't really water bath my pickles, which is another reason why they ferment, because I'm not killing off the bacteria. The preference is yours. Mine are shelf stable, and when we open them up in the middle of winter and we pop that lid and the bubbles start at the bottom of the jar and work their way up to the top and over the edge. We've actually filmed that. Nice. It's like fine champagne. Those are such sparkly cucumber pickles that they were just like my grandmother used to do. And so this is how she did that. She filled them up, wiped the rim off, put the lid on, tightened the band, and then put them in a sink full of hot water. Like you pour boiling water over them, leave them in your sink. I cover them with a towel and leave them in there till they cool. They will seal without being water bath.
Because everything is hot.
Right. And, you know, the air comes out of there. But those will be the ones that if you don't want them fermented, you'll need to put them in a hot water bath for at least 15 minutes, whatever your recipe says. I just prefer that sparkly water that comes out of those jars. You know, like when I have a migraine, nothing makes me feel better than the juice from watermelon pickles. It's one of my favorite things in the whole world.
Okay. But now, pressure canning, though, like, definitely you wouldn't recommend this method for, like, a pizza sauce or something. Like,
right.
Some things absolutely have to
not.
Be.
Okay. I'm actually doing a demonstration at the end of the month for the Minocan Farm, and they let me pick whatever I wanted for a topic, and it was pressure cooking versus water bath canning, because there's a huge difference in what you can can one way and what you can can another way. So there's enough vinegar in a jar of pickles. It's the acid that you need in there. Like tomatoes are acidic. Fruits have lots of sugar and added sugar in them. So if something has a lot of sugar or a lot of acid, that can be water bath. Everything else should be pressure canned.
Okay. What about this thing that they just have called fridge pickles, where you just slice them and you don't even have to seal them, but then they're not shelf stable. They have to be kept in the fridge.
Absolutely. They have to be kept in the refrigerator, and those, they'll last all winter long. I mean, like, that's a good way. Actually, there was a restaurant in Fargo called The Granary, and there's this granary pickle recipe. So that's what they did, is they used to slice cucumbers. You do the same thing. You slice your cucumbers. You put them in. I have this gallon glass jar that I use specifically for a refrigerator pickle. And you can add your spice. You can add as much garlic and chili peppers as you want. Put lots of dill in there if you like dill. Some of them are sweet and sour. You can find sweet and sour refrigerator recipes. And that would be if you're not like a hardcore prepper zombie apocalypse type person, you just make yourself some refrigerator pickles, because the pickles you use,
apocalypse won't impact electricity.
We hope not anyway. But these are the ones, like if you can't get pickling cucumbers, a lot of people will do this because you use the larger slicing.
Right, that's what I end up
pickles
doing.
For.
Do you need to worry about the jars being hot and the lids being perfect on this one?
Nope, because I actually just use a screw top, like an industrial mayonnaise jar from a restaurant, you know, a restaurant sized mayonnaise jar that's been thoroughly cleaned, or whatever else you can maybe get a pickle jar like that and then recycle it as a pickle jar. And then there's people who absolutely don't care about pickling their own pickles, will buy a jar of pickles and doctor it up. Like somebody told me about a recipe that uses good season salad dressing mix that you mix in there. And she said her kids just loved them. And then there's the fire and ice, where you take a real strong dill pickle from the grocery store and you add sugar and whatever else to it, and you get kind of a sweet and sour pickle. And it's subjective, man. If you like them sweet and spicy, that's all right. But boy, I'll tell you, my grandma Caseman made such good pickles that it was just kind of like a treat to go to her house, and she would let us eat a whole jar, my husband and I. Oh my gosh. It was awesome. So my goal in life, I really started doing my own pickles, was to try and get her recipe to work for me. So I got it from my Uncle Ed. Oh, here's another little suggestion if you're growing your own cucumbers for pickles, and that is to purchase a pickling cucumber seed. There are certain cucumbers that will grow with a tougher, spinier skin that will actually make a better pickle, and you'll have more success.
All right. We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Ashley.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 29th. Martha and Harry Thompson of Seltz, North Dakota, had six children. Son Gust was born in 1923. Tomorrow would be his birthday. He joined the Army when he was barely 18 and parachuted into Normandy on D-Day. Sometime later, he would become a German prisoner. Two of Gust's brothers also enlisted. Their niece, Jackie Knott related a story about an episode where Harry, her grandfather, was in the local bar when someone mentioned in German that when Germany won the war, everyone would be speaking German. With three of his sons fighting overseas, Harry took exception. Built like a bulldog and really powerful, Harry grabbed the guy and punched him. Four others jumped in, and Harry took them all on and cleaned the bar out. When Harry's son Gus was liberated as a prisoner, he weighed only 86 pounds. He got a farm in Washington State. He and his wife raised two daughters, but they would lose everything in a fire, and Gus's wife ended up leaving him. Gus's sister, Anne, died in 1963. Before she passed, she asked him to raise her 13-year-old daughter, Jackie, a girl he barely knew. Jackie says, "I was bitter and angry when I arrived on his doorstep. He sat me down and listened, and then he told me, 'It may be your parents' fault you are the way you are, but it's your own fault if you stay this way.' The message was crystal clear." Jackie says she owes almost everything to Gus, and she was glad when she had the opportunity to repay him in some measure. As Gus's health failed, he wanted to provide veterans' benefits for his wife, but he couldn't prove he was a veteran. Copies of his military records were lost in the house fire, and a fire in St. Louis had destroyed the originals. Jackie learned Texas billionaire Ross Perot was helping veterans, so she sent him an email. The next day, Perot called her. He would be meeting with the head of the VA and asked her for some hard documentation saying, "I'll shove it in their face and demand they help this man." They found a book that listed POWs, including Gus. Within a week, Gus's wife was approved for survivor benefits. The family was surprised, however, when Gus received a POW disability check. He could have had the benefit all along. Gus passed away 2 months later in June 2004. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
MTV became a global phenomenon soon after showing its first music video, but the network's animated shows were also part of a pop culture moment that encouraged a new generation of artists to be irreverent.
You want to see something really cool?
And original.
It had to be something that you could not see anywhere else.
How animation came to be on MTV, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Dave Thompson steps in as host for our monthly journalist roundtable so that I can head to Medora for Public Media Day. Joining Dave are Jack Zaleski of the Forum Communications and Steve Andrist, former executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.